This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon. This is Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in again this Friday for Tony Perkins. So glad you're listening. By golly, we've got a great program set up for you today. Some interesting topics. We're going to start out talking about a press conference that took place yesterday out in front of the Capitol having to do with defunding Planned Parenthood. There's more stuff that's come out. We're going to be talking with Lila Rose, who can tell us all about that new information. It's information we've been hearing about for a while, but once again, they've confirmed it. We're also going to be talking for a few minutes in our second segment about the Johnson Amendment. And if you don't know what that is, stick around and you'll find out. And then in the last part of the program, our last two segments, we'll be talking about all of this crazy campus unrest that's been going on, supposedly the bastions of free speech, our universities across the country. We're seeing some really kind of nasty stuff popping up on these campuses, or these campi, the Latin for plural of campus. Anyway, let's get into our first topic right away because our guest is waiting. 12 members of Congress joined the pro-life organization Live Action in front of the Capitol yesterday to call for the end of taxpayer funding of abortion giant Planned Parenthood. With us now is founder and president of Live Action, Lila Rose. Lila, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
It is so good to talk with you. We met a couple of years ago, I think, in Kansas City, and well, the work that you're doing is great. First of all, give our listeners a little bit of background about what Live Action is all about. Then we'll dig into this press conference from yesterday.
Sure. So Live Action is a educational and advocacy group focused on teaching about the humanity of the preborn child and exposing abortion and the abortion industry for what it is. We do that through visual media, and we have the largest social media platform for the pro-life movement, reaching up to 30 million people a month with the truth about abortion and life through video, article, through graphics, through different creative ways to get them motivated and inspired.
And you know what? You're a relatively young person, and the thing that excites me so much is, for instance, when you go to the March for Life in Washington, and we had the privilege of being on the broadcast when that took place, there are so many young people who are getting involved in the pro-life movement. Have you seen that to be the case from your experience?
Yes, it's really beautiful to see. I mean, even the Walk for Life or the March for Life, but a lot of the folks that we know we're connecting with every day on social media, a lot of them young people, predominantly young people, a lot of young women, millennials, and women and girls in their teens who are passionate about this. And that's why the polling shows that the pro-life generation is the younger generation in our country, millennials and teens who have the window to the womb with the ultrasound, who have access to independent information, and who are standing up, wanting to stand up for life.
That's excellent. Well, tell us what happened yesterday at the Capitol.
Yesterday at the Capitol was an amazing day. It was really amazing to see the leadership in the House of Representatives that came to our press conference that was co-hosted by these leaders, particularly Representative Diane Black from Tennessee, who has been a lead sponsor of legislation to defund Planned Parenthood. We had other stalwarts there like Representative Chris Smith, Representative Trent Franks, Representative Vicky Hartzler, folks that are standing strong and calling to stop the forced taxpayer funding of Planned Parenthood. So they made it out to the press conference. We had a good crowd of media there, and we live-streamed it with 120,000 people watching live of the press conference, so we were able to reach people across the country simultaneously. But the most powerful thing was the moment that we're in. We're in this moment where we have the opportunity that we haven't had for the last 8 years to actually stop funding Planned Parenthood and stop funding the biggest abortion chain. We just need to get it done. The administration has promised to do it. There's so many leaders in the House and the Senate wanting to do it. Now we're going to get this done to stop spending $500 million a year to abortion giant Planned Parenthood. And we might have to start with an initial 80% cut, but we are creating the path to make this happen under the Trump administration.
Now, we're going to play a sound clip here. It's about a minute and a half, and it's some audio from a series of phone calls that your organization did in terms of an undercover investigation. First of all, to set up that clip, tell us a little bit about what you did.
Sure. So Live Action in the last 2 weeks has been releasing our Abortion Corporation investigative report, which is a series of investigative videos and testimonials from ex-Planned Parenthood workers sharing that despite Planned Parenthood's marketing, they invest really tens of millions of dollars in marketing, and they've done over $100 million for business development, $100 million a year budget for business development. Despite their misleading advertising, they do not provide a lot of the services that they claim to, and they lie to the American public that they're justified to get the taxpayer money that they have by saying they have services like ultrasound, prenatal care, mammograms. The Live Action investigative team really just started calling and visiting facilities saying, do you have prenatal care for women? Because it was something advertised by Planned Parenthood's CEO on national television. It's advertised on websites and by their supporters. And we found we had over 97 facilities that we visited or called. 92 of them said that they had zero prenatal care, but that instead they specialized in abortion.
So this is not a small sampling. This is not just a handful. This is a bunch of them. Now, Brent, I'd like you to go ahead and roll that sound bite, and then, Lila, I'll come back and ask you a little bit more about it. So here it is.
We don't offer any prenatal care.
We don't offer prenatal care at Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood offers abortion, so they don't offer prenatal care.
Prenatal care. These are the kinds of services that folks depend on Planned Parenthood for.
And a president who will fight for prenatal care.
Prenatal care. And that is what we want to focus on. That is what is so vital.
Thank you for calling Planned Parenthood. My name is Heck, can I assist you today?
Hi, I was hoping to make an appointment for prenatal care.
For what type of service?
Prenatal care, pregnancy care.
We don't have prenatal care here. Planned Parenthood offers abortion, so they don't offer prenatal care.
Okay, just abortions.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no, we wouldn't provide any type of prenatal services here at Planned Parenthood.
We're not a prenatal care provider. No, Planned Parenthood does prenatal care.
We don't offer prenatal care at Planned Parenthood.
We specialize in abortions. You know, that's what our ultrasounds are for, to see how far along the patient is.
Planned Parenthood, we do birth control, you know, things like that, termination. We check for STI, but we don't do prenatal.
No, we don't do prenatal services. I mean, it's called Planned Parenthood. I know it's kind of deceiving.
Do you have OBGYNs here?
We do not, no.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which is a deceptive name, right? I think the same thing.
Or, you know, if you were looking at termination options, we can do that as well.
Well, Lila, it sounds to me what we had there was a sort of a juxtaposition of actual phone calls and some audio from, it sounds like some of your folks actually went into clinics, juxtaposed with speeches from Planned Parenthood officials. Do I have that right?
That's correct, including Planned Parenthood's own CEO and president, Cecile Richards, who was saying on national television that we need to have access to prenatal care. And that's part of the bid for their taxpayer funding when prenatal care is negligible at Planned Parenthood, and instead they're focused on abortion.
Well, they are in a very vulnerable position now, because as this information gets out to the public, and the public really sees what's going on, and, you know, there's a local Planned Parenthood not too far from where I'm sitting right now, and you drive by there and they have this big pink banner that's stuck up on the side of the building, which I think is an ordinance violation, by the way, in the city that it sits in Overland Park, Kansas. But it says something like health care happens here. Have you seen any of those banners on Planned Parenthood's?
Well, they have banners, they have online ad campaigns. Evan, they're investing tens of millions of dollars in promoting their brand. And their brand, they're trying to make their brand women's health care in order to defend their taxpayer support and their public legitimacy. But their focus is abortion, and they have very limited health services for women. I mean, they provide less than 1% of all pap smears in our country for women every year. They provide less than 2% of annual breast exams. Manual breast exams, they provide 0% of mammograms, and yet their market share of abortion is 34%, 34% of all abortions. So it's stunning to see the discrepancy between their amount of actual cancer screenings versus, which is less than 2% for the whole country, versus the amount of abortions, which is 34%.
Now, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that part of the work that you've done is to talk with ex-Planned Parenthood employees. Are you finding that the information that you're getting from them is consistent with what you're finding in your undercover phone calls and visits in terms of what they do and don't provide?
Yes, so it's striking to hear the testimonies of ex-Planned Parenthood managers, and it totally corroborates our findings that Planned Parenthood does not provide or provides negligible prenatal services, and that they use ultrasounds. They have ultrasound machines at their facilities, at their tax-funded facilities, but they only use those ultrasound machines for abortion, I mean, predominantly. And these are, you know, tools that can be used to check the sex of the baby, the gestation of the baby, the health of the baby, but they're being used for search and destroy missions, for killing that baby through abortion. And the managers, the video we released this week of ex-Planned Parenthood manager Sue Thayer talks about that. Sue talks about, well, she was managing Planned Parenthood facility. She got an ultrasound machine there, and the tech was setting it up, and he looked at her and he said, I guess this won't be used for ever printing a picture of the ultrasound because it would just be used for telemed abortions. So basically long-distance abortions where they find the size of the baby on the ultrasound in the facility and then prescribe abortion pills to the woman. So it's just striking to hear the testimonies corroborate what our investigative findings are of Planned Parenthood, again, focused on killing and not care.
So I'm sure that there's been a tremendous amount of pushback from Planned Parenthood and from those in Congress and those outside Congress, women's groups and others that support Planned Parenthood. What are you seeing? What do you think the chances are of actually tipping this thing over and getting the funding pulled, the federal funding of, as you said, about more than $500 million a year?
I think that our chances are very good to get this 80% of defunding to be to happen this year for Planned Parenthood for 1 year. That would happen through reconciliation, which would ultimately bar Planned Parenthood from reimbursing, you know, getting money from the government in the budget for Medicaid, which would be very powerful and effective because that means that money could go elsewhere. It could be reallocated to federally qualified health centers. So the reconciliation process avoids having to surpass the filibuster that the Senate Democrats could put up to fight the defunding. Keep in mind the hot political climate that Planned Parenthood has given tens of millions of dollars to their elected officials in Congress to win support. They have donated to almost every Democrat senator. And so the senators who are, you know, wanting to defend Planned Parenthood because that's a lobbyist group for them, are going to try to filibuster a clean legislation that would completely stop funding Planned Parenthood, which is why they're strategizing to do this through reconciliation. The reconciliation is a step in the right direction. I believe that that's going to happen, and I believe President Trump has signaled that he'd sign it. The tricky part is that's 80% defunding of Planned Parenthood for 1 year. So that's about a little over $400 million for 1 year, which is great, but it's not the end game. We still have work to do.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a good start to me, and hopefully it can be something that can then be continued. Well, Lila, I just have to say thanks so much for the work that you and your organization are doing. You know, we have to combat the lies, and they are lies, of Planned Parenthood trying to convince everybody that they provide a whole lot of health care when they really don't. So, Lila, we appreciate you taking time out of what I know is a really busy schedule. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We appreciate it. Well, coming up next, President Trump made big news yesterday when he mentioned his vow to repeal the Johnson Amendment. Christiana Holcomb of Alliance Defending Freedom will join us here in just a couple of minutes to talk about that. You'll learn what the Johnson Amendment's all about and why it's important to repeal it. You're listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network.
So the election is over. The inaugural festivities are done. Now it's time to get to work. The new administration has promised a lot. But do you know what Donald Trump will do during his first 100 days in office? Family Research Council has laid out a conservative playbook for the president-elect to follow in order to repair some of the damage done by the Obama administration's liberal elite special interests. The first 100 days of the Trump administration will be a critical window of opportunity to accomplish a host of policy initiatives that will protect the sanctity of life, natural marriage, and religious liberty. In a timely panel discussion, FRC experts, along with March for Life President Jeannie Mancini, lay out a game plan for executive actions and judicial appointments that the Trump administration can do in its first 100 days to advance religious liberty and the dignity of human life. Visit frc.org/first100 to view this policy discussion.
The rapid response arm of 8 Days of Hope is responding to tornado victims in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. On January 21st, a tornado severely damaged hundreds of homes and killed 4 people. Will you please volunteer to help Hattiesburg residents? Here's 8 Days of Hope director, Steve Tiber.
We need your help today. I mean, it's that simple. We're looking for people who just want to serve others. You know, you don't have to be super gifted. Every disaster gives an opportunity for a believer to share a glimpse of Jesus Christ. You know, the best sermon I ever heard was the one I saw. We're just there to love others as God commands us. And here's where you and I get to be the hands and feet of Jesus Christ.
To volunteer to help with Hattiesburg tornado relief, please visit 8daysofhope.com. Financial donations are also needed to support this ministry effort. To give, please visit 8daysofhope.com and pray for this relief effort and for the families affected by this devastating tornado. 8 Days of Hope is a nonprofit Christian ministry.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. In Basra, Iran, 40 Muslim women were horrifically killed for refusing to wear a hijab, the head covering Muslim women are forced to wear. In Somalia, a Christian woman was murdered by Muslim men because she wasn't wearing a hijab. The list could go on and on. The hijab is a symbol of oppression. Yet last week, some Western feminists encouraged all women to wear a hijab on World Hijab Day, a day set aside to supposedly oppose prejudice. However, where is their support for the Muslim women who are killed because they don't want to wear a hijab? It is far more likely that women in Muslim countries will be killed for not wearing a hijab than women in the West will be persecuted because they do wear a hijab. World Hijab Day is not about religion, but about Islamic supremacy. Oppose it. Your freedom and perhaps one day your life may be at stake. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Good to have you along today. Well, if you don't know what the Johnson Amendment is, you're about to find out. President Trump is vowing to repeal it, and he made the promise at Thursday's National Prayer Breakfast. Joining us now is Christiana Holcomb. She serves as legal counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom. Christiana, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about a little bit of history. Tell us where the Johnson Amendment came from. I know it was named after Lyndon Johnson because he's the guy that got it passed. Tell us a little bit about the history of the thing.
That's exactly right. So back in 1954, then Senator Lyndon Johnson was embroiled in a really vicious reelection campaign, and there were 2 secular nonprofits that he saw as standing in his way, harming his chances of getting reelected. And so he contacted the IRS commissioner, wanted to know if they were breaking any laws, and was told no. So Johnson introduced an amendment that would silence those secular nonprofits. And that's what has been come to known as the Johnson Amendment. It was passed without debate, without legislative analysis. And frankly, at the time it was passed, I don't know that anyone ever anticipated that it would be applied to silence the speech of pastors and churches across the nation. But that's exactly what has happened in the intervening 60 years since the Johnson Amendment passed.
So what kind of impact has this? 1954, I'll have to confess, that was the year I was born. But so that's been around. It's been around for a long time. What impact has it had in practically speaking? What has it done to speech, and particularly what has it done to speech from the pulpit?
Well, practically speaking, the Johnson Amendment has served to muzzle speech. It's turned the IRS into speech police such that they can regulate and monitor and censor speech that even comes from a pastor's sermon, something a pastor communicates from the pulpit. And so what that has done, as you said, in the intervening 60-plus years since the Johnson Amendment passed, is it's really ushered in a regime of intimidation and self-censorship from America's pastors. They're fearful of incurring the wrath of the IRS, of having investigations, and potentially even jeopardizing their own church's tax-exempt status simply for what they say from the pulpit.
Yeah, that seems to be the big fear as well. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there have been just a handful, if even that many, actual cases brought against pastors, and none of them have been, quote unquote, convicted or have lost their tax exempt status. Am I right on that?
You're exactly right that no church has ever permanently lost its tax-exempt status. However, the IRS, again, just prefers to rely on intimidation tactics. So it, for example, has launched multiple year-long investigations into churches and audits of churches simply for what their pastors may have said from the pulpit. And that in and of itself is a fearful thing to pastors across the nation.
And it can get really expensive, too, because you have to bring in legal help, and or in the case of Alliance Defending Freedom, a great group like yours will come in and help churches. Well, how did this repeal effort get started to begin with?
Well, President Trump, as you mentioned, even just yesterday, noted the unconstitutionality of the Johnson Amendment and something that he really recognizes needs to be fixed. But Alliance Defending Freedom has really been at the forefront of this effort for nearly a decade now. Back in 2008, we launched what we called our Pulpit Initiative to really raise awareness of the fact that the IRS was abusing its power and using the Johnson Amendment to censor the speech of pastors. And so we're just delighted to have reached a point at which not only the President of the United States, but frankly a number of members of Congress as well have recognized that the Johnson Amendment needs to be fixed. We've got to address this issue. And so just on Wednesday, members of both houses of Congress introduced new legislation, the Free Speech Fairness Act, that would help to fix the Johnson Amendment and allow pastors to speak freely again.
Is there any opposition to it? I mean, what's the other side, or is there another side?
I mean, certainly there are those who don't think that pastors and churches should, quote-unquote, what they call politicking or have any say in politics. But what they don't recognize is that's a determination that should be made individually by pastors and churches. That's not something the IRS should be allowed to determine, what a pastor says from the pulpit. So certainly there will be those who come out against it, but by and large, this should be a bipartisan issue. It should be something that everyone from both sides of the aisle agrees that the IRS needs to be removed from the business of being speech police.
Well, you know, I find it interesting. You mentioned, at the top of our conversation that initially the thing that was the genesis of this, the catalyst of it, was two secular nonprofit groups. And it's interesting that the focus has been on pastors.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, pastors are really at the heart of the First Amendment protection. And the Johnson Amendment, as it is being applied and utilized by the IRS, infringes not only on a pastor's free speech, but his religious freedom as well. His right to choose how to expound the scriptures and to apply it to every aspect of life. And it really should be a pastor's decision whether or not he's going to apply the scriptures even to candidates and to elections.
Let's turn a slight corner here, because the Johnson Amendment and the whole IRS thing and losing your nonprofit status is one thing that has squelched speech. But then are there not some other things out there like so-called hate speech laws that in other countries have actually been used effectively to tell pastors, and by the way, we just have a little bit less than a minute here, to tell pastors, you know, you can't talk about sexuality from a biblical perspective. Comment on that, if you would.
Certainly. We've seen other countries, Canada being one prime example, where hate speech laws have been used to censor what pastors say from the pulpit. So I think it's important to recognize that this is a slippery slope. If you cede this ground to the government and allow the government to control what is said from the pulpit, who knows where it's going to stop? This is something that must be addressed now.
Very good. Well, Christiana, we appreciate the work that ADF does, Alliance Defending Freedom, and the work that you're doing as well. When do you think this is going to actually come to a vote, or do you know?
Hopefully very soon.
Okay.
We'll
keep our eye on it. Christiana Holcomb with Alliance Defending Freedom, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, coming up next, violence is breaking out on campuses across the country. Those calling for tolerance apparently are intolerant of conservative views. Ben Shapiro knows of these attacks well. We just stay tuned as we hope to be able to get him on the line and talk with him about this. And if you've been watching the news the last couple of days, last couple of evenings, you know what's going on. You're listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, we got some great news today in the economy. We got our job numbers. U.S. created 227,000 private sector jobs. My prediction was 218,000, so I was close. Unemployment rate, 4.8%. Here's the good news. We got a labor participation rate of 62.9. Yes, we're still in the high 1970s. My prediction moving forward is by the end of this month, so this time next month, when we get the February job numbers, I think we're going to be out of the 1970s. That's my prediction. Out of the 1970s next month. If we're not, I'm going to blame it on the short month of February. But I think, I believe, we are headed fast to the 21st century of labor participation. And I think that's very good news. Now, the wage numbers were down a bit. Some people are concerned. Don't be concerned, because last month we had an unusually high wage number. So not a big deal. Also, hours worked per week stayed unchanged at 34.4, where we've been since 2008. But I'm not concerned about that. Right now, I just want to see more and more people coming back into the labor force. And as a matter of fact, when this happens, unemployment rates should go up. That's going to be a good thing, though the liberals will all be whining and complaining about Trump over it.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fallon with Bot Radio Network, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. So glad to have you along on this Friday afternoon. Well, the next couple of segments are going to be interesting, and I want to give you our phone number so you can jot it down, because in segment four, we're going to be taking your calls and talking with you about this topic and maybe the other two that we talked about earlier. 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. We like to get you on board starting about 40 minutes after the hour. Well, over the past couple of years, there's been increasing violence. And lately, particularly this week, riots on college campuses protesting conservative points of view. With us now is Ben Shapiro, editor-in-chief of The Daily Wire. He also produces the most listened-to conservative podcasts on the internet. Ben, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Ben, I have enjoyed watching you, listening to you, and reading the things that you write, because they're so compelling and so spot on. It's just wonderful to have you on the broadcast today. If you would, tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, what's been going on, particularly these last few days. First of all, out in Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement. And then I believe it was last night at the NYC campus, or NYU campus, rather.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's been going on largely has been happening across college campuses. It's not unique to Berkeley. It's not unique to NYU. There's this widespread perception on college campuses now that if you're offended, that this gives you a status of virtue, and that status of virtue allows you to act out in violence against people who disagree with you. So this is why, you've probably heard something about the language of microaggression, and you've been wondering what the heck's a microaggression. Well, microaggression is just the idea that somebody says something that offends you, even if it's not objectively offensive, that this is some sort of aggression against you, and therefore you get to react in kind. And so what that means is that if someone invades your safe space by microaggressing you, then you get to react violently. Speech is violence in this view. And so it's not a shock that you've seen dissenting speakers across the spectrum being shouted down on campuses, being banned from campuses, being rioted against on campuses. And what we saw in Berkeley this week actually is not all that unique. It's been kind of happening all over the country. It's not every campus, obviously, but it has happened at multiple campuses. I speak at 25, 30 campuses a year minimum. And I would say that 10% of the campuses, 20% of the campuses at which I appear, there's something that resembles this to a more or less extent. I mean, I spoke at Cal State Los Angeles last February, and there was almost exactly this. There was nearly a full-scale riot. They had to call the cops. There were helicopters. I had to be escorted off campus by motorcycle officers flashing their lights. So this is not, it actually is not an isolated incident.
Well, let's talk a little bit first about what happened at Berkeley. There was a speaker there who's a libertarian, he's gay, and he's very conservative, and it's just kind of an interesting mix of characteristics. But supposedly the people that organized that spent about $6,000 at the request of the university to pay for police officers, and then this guy didn't even have a chance to speak, as I understand, and there were fires set, and then, you know, the police didn't arrest anyone. My understanding from some reading I did today is that there is essentially a no-arrest procedure put in place by the Berkeley Police Department. Can you confirm that?
That's my understanding as well. That was the standard at Cal State Los Angeles. They have a lawsuit right now against Cal State Los Angeles for the same issue, where there was a bunch of people protesting, rioting, and the cops were told by the administration to stand down and let them do what they were going to do, basically. You know, make sure that nobody got hurt, but aside from that, don't arrest anyone, don't do anything about it. So, yeah, I mean, I'd heard some of the same things. I said so on Fox News last night that I thought that that's what would happen. It's really pretty ridiculous. Yeah, as far as the speaker himself, I think that there are a few points to be made about this sort of thing. Number one, there's a growing sense in America on the left, and to a smaller, much smaller extent on the right, that violence in pursuit of political ends is okay. Well, once you believe that violence in pursuit of political ends is okay, you're now fascist. You don't get to engage in violence just because you disagree with somebody coming on campus and saying something with which you disagree, even if that person is really quite yucky. Second, if the left has done this routine now where they say, okay, it's okay to punch Nazis, and then they say everybody's a Nazi. Right? So they'll say it's okay to punch Richard Spencer, who's this white supremacist, white nationalist, on the streets of D.C., therefore, it's okay to punch Milo. Therefore, it's okay to punch, you know, a bunch of other people on the right. And that is really quite a terrible thing to say, not just because it condones violence, but also because it broadens the definition of evil to include things that aren't actually evil, and also because it excludes certain things that are evil from the conversation. So, you know, they'll allow radical Palestinian terrorists to speak on campus, but they won't allow people who are sort of mainstream conservatives to speak on a campus. That's a problem. And then finally, these leftists are so stupid, because if there's one thing that people like Milo want, this sort of attention. Milo didn't care about speaking at Berkeley last night or the other night. Milo cared about the riot. I mean, it makes Milo famous. It makes Milo, you know, more prominent, and Milo's a provocateur. It's exactly what he wants. And by the way, I think a lot of what Milo says is actually quite awful. I think, just to give you an example, and Milo says the Jews run the media. He characterized the Jewish BuzzFeed writer earlier this year as a typical example of the sort of thick-as-pig-bleak media Jew. He's justified anti-Semitic memes. He calls himself a fellow traveler with the alt-right. Hey, there are a lot of problems with Milo.
Right.
But the problem is that you grant him a lot of credibility, and, you know, suddenly his audience goes from 500 people at Berkeley to 5 million people on Fox News, because you just made him a national issue, and then he goes on national TV and gets to portray himself as a mainstream guy. So it achieves precisely the reverse of what you're trying to do if you actually don't want his views promulgated.
And then we end up talking about it. But, of course, we're talking about the bigger issue of freedom of speech. Well, Ben, I'd like to hold you over to the next segment, and hopefully we'll get some calls in here after we chat a bit more about this topic, if you can. And then we'll also take some callers to talk with Ben Shapiro. Well, it's Ben Shapiro, editor-in-chief of The Daily Wire. We'll be talking with him again after the break. We'll follow up and continue to talk about this conversation and take your calls at 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. You're listening to Washington Watch.
It is interesting that in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the first and last rays of sunlight fall every day upon its tallest building, the 555-foot Washington Monument. And there on its top, inscribed on the four-sided aluminum capstone, are the Latin words Laus Deo, which means praise be to God. This simple expression of praise reflects America's abiding belief that God has blessed our country with liberty and divine favor. Hello, everyone. Tim Wildman again. We're going to Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, for our spiritual heritage tours in June and September, and we'll see this Washington Monument. That's only one of the many monuments and places we'll see. Stephen McDowell of the Providence Foundation will lead the way as we talk about the places, the time, the events, and the people of our early American Christian heritage. For more information, visit the website spiritualheritagetours.com. That's spiritualheritagetours.com.
Sandy Rios in the morning.
This is a time of madness, it really is. This is from the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. He said, evil attacks the weakest, denies truth and love, is defeated through Jesus Christ. And I just love that. Evil is defeated through Jesus Christ. And so let's not be afraid. And if you are afraid, then, you know, make yourself right with God.
Sandy Rios in the morning. Weekday mornings at 7 Central on American Family Radio.
Is God calling you to pursue theological graduate education? What's keeping you from taking the first step? Is it time? What if you could choose from flexible class options? Is it money? What if competitively priced seminary offered academic scholarships? Do you think you're alone? What if your classmates were just like you, balancing careers and families with seminary? Hello, I'm Dr. John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Take the first step. Visit wbs.edu.
Dan Celia of Financial Issues.
I think income ultimately is the most important thing that we protect. I know one thing, and I know this from sitting across a lot of tables from a lot of people over the years, that at some point in time, maybe it's 75, maybe it's 85, there will be a point in time where the only thing you care about is how much income you have coming in. Don't let your portfolio be 100% subject to the volatility in the markets or dependent upon the market. Shore up some permanent income, along with Social Security and your maybe a pension, have some charitable gift annuity to shore that up. I hope you'll call the AFA Foundation today and find out more detail about a charitable gift annuity.
Call and speak with a representative of the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler here from Bot Radio Network, sitting in today for Tony Perkins. By the way, TonyPerkins.com, TonyPerkins.com, the website where you can get more information about what Tony's been up to and Family Research Council, and you can listen to previous broadcasts of this program in case you missed the first part or the middle part. This has been a great broadcast today, lots of good topics. And then Tony's Twitter handle is @TPerkins. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Tell him how I'm doing today, if you would. Good, better, and different. Anyway, we have Ben Shapiro on the line. He's the editor-in-chief of the Daily Wire. Ben, so good to have you. Thanks for being here today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, I want to jump into another piece of this topic. President Trump sent out a tweet condemning the carnage and the rioting and suggested that UC Berkeley might just be deprived of some of its federal funding for not standing by some of its principles, the free speech principles that it touts. What do you think about that as a remedy, good, bad, or indifferent?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that as a remedy, it's kind of hard to do legally. Most of the federal money that's coming in are scientific grants that are disconnected from these sorts of security issues. The idea of if there is federal money going to a school that's not doing its job to protect free speech, I have no problem whatsoever with the federal government using whatever levers it has at its control to ensure free speech on a public campus. My heart is with Trump if my brain isn't. You know, the legal question is aside from the moral question. Yeah, I mean, if Trump wants to exert leverage on UC Berkeley to get them to defend free speech, then sure, go for it.
Well, you know, and the market may prevail here as it did at the University of Missouri. There's some crazy stuff that happened there. That is the alma mater of our producer, Russ Jones. And I don't know if our listeners recall, perhaps you recall, Ben, do you remember that the video of the, I think she was a journalist, redheaded journalism professor who was pushing cameras away. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, okay. You remember at University of Missouri, there was some stuff going on. It was probably over a year ago, but there was a journalism professor who pushing reporters away because she didn't want to have any questions asked. So that's a great example for a journalism professor.
Melissa Click, I believe her name was, yeah.
That's it. That's right. And, you know, what was interesting is that apparently donations from alumni to the University of Missouri dropped quite a bit. And, you know, that's okay. I think, you know, the alumni can't support that kind of stuff going on for, you know, they've probably been giving money for years and years and years, and they see what's happened to their alma mater, and they say, you know, no more of this. So, you know, it seems to me, Ben, that there is a kind of a nexus here between a couple of things. First of all, you've got these people, and there have been some stories suggesting that perhaps at Berkeley, that some of the folks who were writing were not necessarily students. Can you speak to that and what Robert Reich said today?
So, you know, Robert Reich has no evidence. When he says that Milo or the Wright, you know, went out and hired people to do this sort of stuff, that's sort of false flag nonsense that normally you see from Alex Jones's side of the aisle. So I don't believe that at all, or at least I see no evidence of it. As far as the idea these weren't Berkeley students, I actually do agree with that. I think a lot of these people were not Berkeley students. I spoke at Berkeley last year, no problem. It was one of the most peaceful campuses I visited, as opposed to, you know, Penn State, where it actually got violent. So, you know, I think that if there were students, then it's hard to tell because they're in those black masks. But it mostly looked to me like a black bloc group that invaded this kind of student body. Now, the question is why the cops didn't do anything about it. And that seems to me more of a question than how many Berkeley students were actually involved. If there were Berkeley students involved in doing this sort of stuff, by the way, they should be immediately expelled. I don't think that when I look at that crowd, you have a bunch of people who they look more to me like, you know, 1999 World Trade Organization in Seattle anarchists than like Berkeley students.
Where do those people come from? Do you have any idea?
A lot of them are professional protesters. A lot of them are paid by foreign groups. A lot of them show up to these sorts of events because they're ne'er-do-wells who live in kind of kooky areas like Seattle and Berkeley. Maybe there's some students among them. But again, I my own personal experience being on campus when there's violence and when things get rough like that, the people who tend to get violence on campus are not the people who come wearing masks over their faces with actual weapons on them. That usually is another group using the cover to infiltrate.
Well, Ben, would you like to take a couple of phone calls from listeners with me?
Sure, happy to.
Let me toss out the number again. We do have we have some calls online here, but the number is 866-372-7234. That's 866-372-7234. Riley is on the line from Indiana. Riley, welcome to Washington Watch. Riley, are you there? All right, we'll take another call here from John. John in Georgia. John wants to talk about this Berkeley situation. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, sir. Ben, it's an honor to talk to you. I'm a huge fan. I saw your YouTube video where you eviscerated Piers Morgan on gun control and also the Black Lives Matter debate. That was hilarious, and I really
appreciate
your service to our country. I completely agree with everything you said about the riots at Berkeley, and I think another disturbing trend is the online censorship that we see from Facebook and Reddit as they label, you know, so-called alt-right, which is subjectively defined, to limit free speech. Now, I realize they're private companies, so I think they can do what they want, but it's another aspect of this disturbing trend. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think the alt-right is a really devastatingly negative movement. I think that there's a lot of people who think that, so people don't actually know what the alt-right is, because the media have done a terrible job of explaining what the alt-right is, and because the alt-right does a good job of trying to obscure what it is itself. So the sort of philosophical founders of the alt-right are actual white nationalists, white supremacists, who believe that culture is inseparable from race, that basically white Europeans started Western civilization, and therefore any foreign population in that strain is a problem. There are a lot of people who have sort of called themselves alt-right now because the alt-right said, well, we're just people who like Donald Trump, or we're just people who like to put funny memes online. And so a lot of people, not knowing what the alt-right actually is, have started calling themselves alt-right. But there is this core of alt-right people, the Richard Spencers, the Jared Taylors, and they're popularizers. And Yiannopoulos is one of the popularizers of the alt-right, who's forwarded, you know, this sort of racialist thinking. And that's the problem. And this is one of the things that is disturbing to me about sort of the modern state of politics. Everybody is so reactionary. Everybody's so reactionary. Instead of just standing up for what's right and what's true, people on the right too much these days are saying, okay, well, it ticks off the left, or it triggers the left, therefore I like it. And people on the left are saying, oh, it's the anti-Trump, therefore I like it. How about instead of determining whether something ticks off the left or ticks off the right, we determine whether it's true. And then we support it if it's true, and we don't support it if it's false. That seems to me a better way of living, but I think that, unfortunately, politics is so polarized that it's much more about enemies than about truth.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if we got back to more of what we used to call civil discourse?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even about civility as much as it is about what's true. I mean, obviously, I'd like civil discourse. I want to get rid of the violence. But I think that on all sides these days, there's a tendency to embrace narratives that you think are beneficial to your cause, even if they're not true, and to reject narratives that are true if they're not beneficial to your cause. And this is why you're seeing so much news going around that seems to be fake from the left. You know, they just kind of spout out narratives about Trump that aren't remotely true, or they say that he's responsible for a Muslim ban, which isn't true. And then you see narratives from the right that also aren't true about the size of Trump's inauguration crowd. It's like, well, why? What's the point of all this? How about we just look at the facts honestly and openly, and then we can determine whether all this stuff is true or not, as opposed
Very
to
good.
Rooting for sides and determining what's true based on which side we're on.
Well, Tracy's on the line from Oklahoma. Tracy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Yes, thank you. I guess I had a couple of comments. The Berkeley thing, I guess I'm appalled that my taxes probably helped pay for that campus, and then it's being destroyed and nobody's being arrested for that. I mean, if it was the right movement, yeah, I guarantee you some conservatives would probably be arrested over something. So it's kind of a shame that there's a talk about the unfairness of what Hillary was talking about, you know, I'm treated unfairly. Well, it seems like they're being treated more unfairly by not being arrested. The other thing is the DNC emails where they kind of got Bernie Sanders out of there with their emails. How is that any different from the potential Russian hacking of the election? And I'll just hang on while you comment on that.
Okay, thanks, Tracy. Ben, you want to comment on that?
I'm not really sure what the question is. I mean, I think go ahead.
Yeah, it was a little bit off our topic, but talking about comparing the unfairness that Hillary Clinton voiced with respect to the email hacking versus Russia. I don't know if you have any comments
on
that.
I think that, again, this is an area where a little intellectual honesty would go a long way, and that is, yes, you know, the DNC tried to rig this thing for Hillary Clinton. That's entirely true, and it's entirely immoral. That said, sort of the DNC's business. It's a private organization. They can do what they want to do. If they don't want to hand the nomination to Bernie Sanders, I guess that's their stupid problem. It didn't work out well for them. As an American, I'm not pleased with the idea of the Russian government hacking American institutions in an attempt to influence American elections. Imagine a very easy test for politics these days. Just imagine the situation were reversed. Imagine for a second the Russian government had hacked the RNC, released a bunch of nasty material about Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump had lost the election. Would we be crying bloody murder? You bet we would. So I think that we can all say, I think that Hillary would have lost regardless of the Russian hacking, because I think Hillary is an awful, awful candidate. But that said, should I be rooting for Russian hacking? Should I be trying to pretend that it doesn't matter to me that the Russians hacked the DNC? No, of course I think it's ridiculous the Russians hacked the DNC. And I'm glad to see that President Trump is finally coming around to that position after a couple of months of kind of putting around with it. Now he's saying he wants an investigation into it. He wants to stop it. Okay, good. I mean, that's where he should be. For the sake of America, we should not want foreign powers hacking into important public institutions.
Yeah, and it seems like the emphasis was on the hacking as opposed to the content of the emails.
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, the content is, I think that we all have to be very careful now, because the reality is we all live online, and I'm not sure anybody wants their emails read in public. I mean, raise your hand right now if you want your emails read in public. I don't think you do. And so I think that just as a country, we ought to be very careful with this new standard that everything that gets released into public that used to be private is something that you should be held publicly accountable for, because one day that could be your email being read on CNN, and you're not going to be quite so happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Larry, we tried to get Larry earlier from Indiana, and somehow he dropped off. Larry, are you with us now?
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking
All right.
Go. I wouldn't talk about the idea of free speech on the left. I was in Berkeley in, I think it was 69 or 70. I can't remember the year, but I'd just been in the military, actually had started to be radicalized towards the left while still in the military, got out, and joined the radical left in California, in Berkeley specifically. I was part of a street theater group, and we did things with the Black Panthers, SDS, different kinds of outfits like that. There was a fellow, a Black Panther named, his name was Fred Hansen or Fred Clark. He was killed by the Chicago police, in 69. And the next day, the, Black Panthers had a rally at Sproul Plaza, and there were basically thousands of, college students there. And what they're, why they had everybody there was to basically harangue them. And call the white students names, honkies, and basically criticize them for not being radical enough and not being angry enough. Well, this friend and I, we started to talk back to them, saying, "Hey, we're here to support you. You know, why are you calling us names? Why? You know, what's going on?" Well, they didn't like just two fellows out of thousands speaking back to them. They sent up some enforcers who escorted us off the premises. So the left has never been in favor of free speech except for theirs.
So this is 100% true. No, it's 100% true. When everybody talks about the free speech movement in Berkeley in the 1960s, a lot of the free speech movement was based on the idea that they were going to take over public spaces and then ban people they didn't like from the public spaces. So it was a misnomer even then. I mean, there was a reason that Governor Reagan had to send in actual state troops to Berkeley, you know, in order to break up, you know, the so-called free speech movement. So, you know, everybody has sort of this sort of mythos about the beautiful left in the 1960s, and it wasn't so beautiful then. It's not so beautiful now.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, the fact that, and you talked about this earlier, is, and we won't say that this is necessarily a fact. It's a strong rumor that that the Berkeley police were asked to kind of stand down and just let things happen. And as opposed to, my understanding is at NYU, there were at least a handful of arrests. You know, it seems to me, and Ben, just comment on this, it seems to me that if you don't have law enforcement enforcing law, it just encourages the folks that are out there trying to tear things up and burn things down.
100% right. I mean, if you've got a situation where people are actually doing property damage and harming other people, and the cops are sitting by because they've been told, no, we don't want to expel the snowflakes on college campus, you know, they're allowed to break things, then you're going to get exactly the same behavior that you would expect to get from your three-year-old if you let your three-year-old run wild. And never punish them, never give them a time out. I speak from personal experience. I have a 3-year-old right now. So, you know, if you want more of that sort of behavior, all you have to do is continue treating adults like children. It turns out they'll act like children.
I'm going to take one more quick call from Patrice in Arkansas. Patrice, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. I hope that the insurance company that insured those buildings tell the university that they should pay for it, since they did not actively try to arrest the people that were breaking things. You know, I don't see why they should have to. And I also hope that the young lady who was sprayed in the face, the girl that was wearing the Trump hat, I hope mm-hmm. she sues the university too. Because it's just not
yeah,
right.
Yeah, well, she certainly has a case. Yeah, I agree. I think that she certainly has a case for them failing to provide security at these events. I mean, I say that as somebody who has a currently active lawsuit against the California University for failing to protect. I mean, I'm not the only plaintiff in that lawsuit. There are a bunch of students who are plaintiffs in that lawsuit because they were prevented from holding the event they wanted to hold. And I believe there are plaintiffs, if I'm not mistaken, who actually were harmed during the near riot at Cal State LA. So, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. Look, these universities
Absolutely.
Have a responsibility to provide security. If the universities can't provide security, then, you know, they shouldn't be having any speakers at all. They should have a blanket rule. There will never be a speaker from the outside, which, by the way, is where they might go with. I mean, that might be the next step, and that would be really negative, because then you have essentially a rioter's veto. Anytime there's a group of people who want to riot, the university will just say we're not going to hold any of that at all.
Ben, thanks so much. Ben Shapiro, editor-in-chief of the Daily Wire. Well, that ends the broadcast for today. This is Evan Fowler for Bot Radio Network, sitting in for Tony today. Thanks for joining us.
Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.